Live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona, you are listening to Breakthrough Thinking. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Isaac. And if it is the second Monday and Tuesday of each month from 3 to 4, it must be Understanding Autism, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon. Guys, how are you?
Doing okay.
Doing all right.
All right. It's an okay and all right. I like that. And a little bit hot in Phoenix. Paul, you flew in from Houston. How's the weather? I always like to do a weather check.
It's about 10 degrees cooler in Houston.
Oh, I'm moving there. That's all I can say. You know what? I was in Houston.
People say that, but when you get there and you start having to swim through the air because it's so humid during the summer, you know, change your mind pretty quick.
I was in Houston at the airport. That's a huge airport.
Which one are you at?
It's not Bush, it's huge.
It's huge. It was big. And
oh, you said it was huge? Sorry, okay.
Yeah. And
Southwest. No.
On my way to and from the Kentucky Derby.
Ah.
By the way, Lexington, Kentucky, beautiful. That's my comment. But we have a great show today. It's on memories. I can't remember what it was about, but it is on memories. Kim, what is the show about?
Well, actually, before we get started, just want to, for first-time listeners, first of all, thank you for understanding our delay. We had a little bit of difficulties, but we're on. And my name is Kim Isaac Emery. Actually, I have a new name. But
did you get married?
I did. But anyway, I am an autism specialist, and I'm a co-host of this radio show. I focus on working with adults and parent training with their families.
And I'm Paul Loudon. I'm an adult on the autism spectrum. I'm 31, and I was diagnosed at 23. So I share my experiences to help people have a bit better idea of what life looks like for someone with autism.
That's such a unique combination. Really beneficial, very helpful, inspires and motivates. Definitely the show to listen to.
Well, thank you. So to start off the show, actually, you're right, we are going to be talking about memory today. However, we do have a piece of news that we wanted to share. Recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association, a study was done by a medical university in Sweden looking at risk factors for autism, environmental and genetic. And it's an interesting study. It's reported to be the largest one of this type so far. And basically, it was just looking at, the influence of both genetic and environmental factors, and they found that, you know, both are factors, and that is important because...
Well, not just that both are factors, but both are approximately equally factors.
Equal factors.
Yes, and that's significant because just 10 years ago, really, it was just said to be just genetic disorder. So they're really expanding research. And, you know, also they looked at extended family members. And that was interesting because they were able to find that children who had an affected cousin had double the autism rate than the general population. And siblings had an increased risk factor that was tenfold.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
But see, that's interesting. I didn't read the study. It's something I'd be interested in. However, the closer you get to the immediate family, they might be subjected to the same environmental factors. Could that be...
Well, that's part of what studies like this look for.
Yeah.
Is, for example, maybe you have siblings who are separated for some reason. Maybe they're brothers, but they're adopted by different families.
Mm.
And so you have the opportunity to look at, you know, whether being in the same place with the same genes has an effect as compared to being in different places with the same genes. There's all kinds of information that gets correlated in these, and they found that when looking at all of it, it looks like it's both genetic and environmental, that we can't really isolate autism as being one cause or the other, that both have approximately equal influence on whether or not someone is likely to have autism.
So then the question might be, and maybe it's in this article or study or not, is that if you were able to identify the environmental factors and then been able to negate that, you know, by moving away and not being exposed to whatever these factors are, how would that impact and offset the genetic factors?
And that's
a good
one
question.
Of the things that, I'm sure they'll be looking at over the coming decades is, you know, which of these factors can we address and which of these factors do we have to accept as unaddressable?
Right. Wow, that's really interesting and great progress, it sounds like.
Yes, well, definitely much research is still needed, but this is a big stride. And also, just if people are wondering what might be considered environmental factors, specific things they were looking at were parental age, birth complications, maternal nutrition at the time of conception, and pollution exposure during certain times during pregnancy. So those are just some examples.
So really early on you're talking about.
Yeah. Typically, a lot of environmental factors that we're learning about now complicate the birth, whether it's low lithium in the mother or things like that, rather than necessarily what the child is exposed to after birth.
Wow, interesting. That is a great study. So if people wanted to read that, can they get to that?
I can post it on our Facebook page.
Yeah, not a bad idea. People may want to be reading something.
Yeah,
I'll certainly try to make that available.
Yeah.
Definitely, yes.
Excellent. So
now we remember memory.
Yeah, I forgot the topic. Not really. That's an overused joke right now. So go ahead. So we got memories.
Yeah. So today we're actually talking about memory and, you know, the different types of memory, the strengths that people with autism have in terms of memory, and also their weaknesses, things that are more difficult for them to learn, therefore, you know, remember. So learning and memory are actually just very connected, and I think people sometimes forget that, because a lot of times we're expecting people to remember things or know things. We're waiting for them to do it or to have the output of it. But it's important to realize that, you know, individuals on the spectrum aren't processing necessarily the same information that we are and that we're remembering. So we have, you know, them processing things and remembering things differently than us and in different ways. And so, you know, we always focus on understanding on the show, so we thought we could talk a little bit more about understanding memory and how it affects the person on the spectrum, and hopefully provide some insight for people to understand better why, you know, there might be some miscommunications or discrepancies and things that happen interactively.
So there's a process to this on how to remember things, how to code things? Is that the general trend where you're going on this, or?
Well, no, actually, like questions I get a lot of from parents are, you know, my child can remember certain things and not others. So, for example, you know, he can remember every line from Disney movies, but he can't remember to turn in his homework. Or, you know, he can't remember something I asked him, you know, 10 minutes ago. And so you have a lot of people wondering, you know, people on the spectrum are able to remember, you know, things like facts and, you know, concrete ideas and definitions and information, and those things they remember really well, and sometimes like exceptionally well, extraordinarily well. But other things like daily life things, they have great difficulty remembering. And so that's something that I get asked a lot, and I think a lot of parents can relate specifically, because it's very confusing for them. And so they automatically assume that their child's just choosing not to pay attention, you know, or just choosing to ignore, you know, certain things that they know, what the parents feel they know they should be doing.
So what's the difference then? I mean, if someone can remember, someone on the spectrum, let's say, can remember vividly and in fact, amazingly, certain facts or figures or whatever, but they can't remember other things, why is there a difference?
Well, think about, for example, math. You meet a lot of people who aren't very good at math, but why? I mean, all math is memorizing formulas and memorizing how to use those formulas. It's knowing and remembering actually a pretty small selection of things. I mean, math, for the most part, algebra is, you know, a few dozen formulas that you use through high school, and there really isn't that much of it compared to the typical amount of stuff you remember on a day-to-day basis about, you know, people around you and social memories. And so for some people, math memory is a lot more difficult, whereas social memory is not a problem. And it's that lack of recognition that even, you know, when it's long-term memory, there are still different types of memories. And people on the autism spectrum have weaknesses in a type of memory that we typically qualify as one that everyone can do. When someone isn't very good at math, we don't say, you know, that they have a disability. But when someone isn't very good at social memory, particularly, we classify that as a disability, because social memory is an aspect of everyday, you know, constant use memory, whereas, you know, algebra, a lot of people find themselves never finding a use for it in their lives after they've left high school.
And plus, I think also there's a perception about math that, you know,
that it's hard.
Exactly.
The truth is that the parts of math that are hard are mostly just memorization. That it is just a question of, can you remember these formulas? And everyone goes, well, no, it's too hard. It's like, well, you know, a squared plus b squared plus c squared, whatever, you know, negative b plus minus square root of 4ac all over the, I can't even remember them now, but I used to know, you know, plenty of formula. And it's just a case of knowing them all, because once you know them all, you can look at your test, you can write them down, you can write their names down and say, okay, this is the one for this one, this is one for this one. That it's a case of knowledge and memory that we qualify as, well, this is hard for some people. But with social memory, with the areas where people with autism are weak, we don't have that conscious thought of, well, this is hard for some people. Instead, it's, well, this is natural, that it's something that everyone can do. I mean, that's been a question that science fiction authors ask a lot. If you look at Blade Runner is a movie about memories, and it's a movie where the question of the movie is, are memories what make us human? That, you know, if you have memories of a human life, are you a human being? And it's one of those things that we do ask a lot, that if you change a person's memories, will that change who they are? If they, you know, have amnesia and they wake up, is it possible for them to have a different personality, or is that caused by the brain damage or the different life experiences, nature versus nurture? We ask as a species constantly, is humanity innate to us, or is it a factor of our experiences? And when you're on the autism spectrum, the memories that you get from your experiences are different. So it's one of those things that what we consider normal human memory and normal human experience is so fundamental that when we meet someone who has it different, we can't, it's not a question of like dehumanizing them so much as it's very hard for us to believe it's real, that it's so fundamental to how we think and how we see things that it's hard for us to imagine that that's really, you know, their experience and that they're not just being lazy or not just making excuses and they don't really care, that we try to equate it to our own life experiences, and that can be really challenging.
And so it might help people. That was a really good way of helping people understand. And I guess a little more technically speaking, but this might make sense to a lot of people, is I think people don't realize there's a lot of different kinds of memory. So sometimes people just think, oh, either you remember or you don't, or you know or you don't. But there's actually different parts of the brain responsible for different types of memory. And so in autism, there are certain types of memory that are really, really strong, which is reflective of parts of the brain that are strong and activated in picking up certain things. And one of those is verbal working memory. And that's really where a person is able to hold verbal information in their mind. Working memory is like the little scratch pad or the scratch paper in your mind, where in a moment that you're in, it's a short-term memory. You know, you're picking up, you know, context, faces, words, things like that as a whole package, working memory in general, and you're able to filter out what you're going to need in the moment. Verbal working memory specifically is for people on the spectrum tends to be a little bit stronger. Now, everybody is different, so not every single person will fit this profile, but in general, this is what research has found, and that also means that they're better at sentence comprehension and verbal-type comprehension. Another type of memory is recognition memory, and that's basically remembering, like, objects or events or people. Like, oh, I know this is Greg, or oh, I know this is Paul. That's another type of memory. Associative memory, which is where you learn and remember things that are unrelated. So, like, you go to a new restaurant, let's say it's called, you know, Sam's. Like, oh, Sam's is a restaurant. You know, and so that's associative memory.
And a restaurant like this other restaurant, maybe.
Right, well, yeah, and then your brain can make different connections.
Because you have to have, but it sounds like, well, when you make that connection, you have to, I would think, have some type of resource or reference point, or else how do you even compare, right? That'd be sort of hard.
And this is where it gets tricky. Yes, you have a good point. We might actually come back to it, because there's a lot of these pieces of memory that they are all sort of intertwined, but these particular ones are easier, or, you know, the brains per person on the spectrum are strong and connected in these areas. Procedural memory is another one, like how to do something, like make a sandwich or brush your teeth.
Like sequential type mechanical stuff.
Right. And those things you just, you know, procedures that you learn. That's another thing that people on the spectrum tend to have an easy time with. semantic memory, which is basically like general knowledge, like definitions, facts, concepts, things like that. That's
and these are all
one.
Different parts of the brain?
Well, that's not isolated, but require different parts.
Oh, okay.
And these parts don't necessarily require that executive functioning piece that so many people on the spectrum have difficulty with. So those are just some kinds of memories that are really strong for a person on the spectrum. So if you think about those kinds of memories and you kind of hear over and over, okay, verbal information, facts, definitions, you know, procedures, things like that, it would make a lot of sense as to why you see a lot of the things that you see, because those are the kinds of memories that they're forming due to what they're learning and how they're processing. Now, you know, on the flip side of that, there's a very important piece of memory that causes people on the spectrum great difficulty, and that's called episodic memory or autobiographical memory. And that really has to do with the who, what, when, where, why, details, your feelings, the time, the place, the integrated package of an experience or episode. So they call episodic memory of an episode. But that requires a lot of multiple processing multiple pieces of those things, and that's what
it's like
difficult.
A jigsaw puzzle. One
sort
piece
of.
Alone, you can't really recognize
well,
it, right?
One interesting thing about episodic memory specifically is that a lot of recent research has found that we don't remember as much as we think we do. That episodic memory, in a large part, is constructed. That we remember bits and pieces, and our mind fills in the gaps.
Oh.
It's, you know, like when you look at a connect the dots picture, and you can immediately recognize what it's a picture of because there's enough dots there for you to go, oh, you know, I don't even need to draw the whole line around it. That's clearly, you know, the map of the United States or, you know, something like that, a piece of cheese, whatever. Is that we remember bits and pieces, and in the neurotypical functioning of the brain, those bits and pieces are enough for us to figure out what was going on. It's one of the reasons that witness testimony in court is often preceded by someone explaining, you know, the weaknesses of witness testimony. And that, you know, when you have two witnesses on the stands who are both telling the truth but tell very different truths because even though they saw the same thing, their focus was elsewhere. And the pieces that really did stick construct a different total picture in the end. And when you have that, that means that, you know, part of memory is your ability to integrate these bits and pieces into a clear picture. When you're on the autism spectrum, your process for both what is important, so what gets stored in memory, and what you can derive from those important things is different. So both the storage and the retrieval process are weakened. And so one of those things might be, you know, the idea that someone would be happy because they've just won the lottery. You might not remember them being happy, so that doesn't go into the memory that they were happy. And then when it comes back, the conclusion that they would be happy isn't one you naturally draw. So if someone asked you, you know, do you think they would have been happy? You say, well, yeah, it makes sense that they would have been happy, but you don't remember them being happy. And maybe the neurotypical person doesn't specifically remember them being happy, but they're so certain that they would be that for their mind's perspective, it's a memory of them being happy.
I like what you said, storage and retrieval, because the storage is, you know, input data coming in, and once it's in there, but as it goes in, it really goes by, and I don't know if you're going to talk about this, filters, various filters. I mean, many people believe all learning is state dependent. I mean, if you're in a certain state of mind, for example, if you're an excited or curious state versus a depressed state, the data coming in and stored will be much different at one state versus another state. And the retrieval coming out will be a reflection of how you stored it plus other filters. Does that make sense?
It definitely does make sense.
I mean,
that's pretty much what I was saying in a way is
okay.
That
yeah.
Autism is one of these filters, that your current mental
gotcha.
State might be one. But yeah. Somewhere along the way, autism is one. And so where another person might pick up a little bit of everyone's body language and a little bit of this and a little bit of that about a scene, and then when they're bringing it back, the body language that they remembered would be factored in. The autistic person may pick up less of the body language.
Yeah.
And then when they bring it back out again, they may weight that less. And so
exactly.
It's a cumulative effect where you're losing
yeah.
going in and you're losing coming out. And exploring that memory and sitting down and really thinking about it, it might come up. But it doesn't come up naturally in the normal retrieval process because there's a very different process between stopping and trying to actively remember something and just seeing what comes up when you hear the song Fly to the Danger Zone, does it bring up memories of Top Gun? Because for a lot of people it does, but if someone's never seen Top Gun, it doesn't.
A reference point. You don't have the reference for it.
And it's like that with autism, is that a memory might bring up memories of one thing or it might not, because they might not encode or have experienced that thing. So a lot of times they haven't experienced things. Even if they've been there and present in the situation, they didn't experience it. They didn't get what the neurotypical person does. And so you have a very different reference structure.
Yeah.
And so the whole memory system is just a different process on the autism spectrum.
That totally makes sense. And also just the process of filters such as deletion, there's generalization, there's distortion. I mean, all these filters are going on, and generalization is or deletion is, you know, people focus on certain things and other people may focus on another part of the experience. So that's why you'd have two different
And generalization is a good example. We already know that a lot of times people on the autism spectrum aren't good at generalizing ideas. So, you know, take the guy who was happy about his lottery ticket winnings. You might generalize in that, you know, when it comes in, you say, oh, he was happy like anyone would be. And so that like anyone would be reinforces the memory. It makes it more concrete because it's actually two memories. He was happy. Anyone would be happy. You have the general picture, and he's a subset of it. If you don't have that, then you just have he was happy. And then when it comes out, the less focus on emotive state means that even he was happy doesn't necessarily come out when you're retrieving it. So having that generalization reference point is, again, important on storage and retrieval. And so it's all of those things that when they work differently, they dramatically change what gets remembered.
There's a lot of information coming in. I know we're going to take a break in a second, but I just wanted to say on top of that, when there's a lot of information coming in, such as, you know, faces, gestures, context, intonation, all of that, that is overload for a person on the spectrum. It really kind of taxes their mental resources. So it's harder for them to pick out what to focus on and what not to focus on.
So but they may be deleting that part of communication. Or information.
Unintentionally, but just because they can't handle that, the volume and the complexity of the information at hand. But why don't we take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion on memory, and actually we're going to even talk a little bit about Savant syndrome, which we haven't really done a lot of on the show.
Yeah, I don't remember that we've ever talked about that.
I don't
think
we've ever brought it up other than mentioning that not every autistic is a savant occasionally.
Yeah, that would be very interesting, and of course this is Understanding Autism live from the Regis Leach in Phoenix, Arizona. We'll be right back.
Beerenbaum Baum and Speen PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Beerenbaum and Speen works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Reidenauer, Heinzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm.
ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Reidenauer, Heinten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You are listening to Understanding Autism Live here at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. Now we call it Regis East and Regis West as we opened up the second office and studio in the west part of Phoenix. So this is Regis what?
East.
It is Regis East. Anyway, our topic today, memory and maybe plural. Is that plural? Memories? Yeah,
well,
I guess it is.
I'm talking about the concept of memory.
Yeah.
So not necessarily specific memories, but the concept of memory and development and processes.
You could have a memory, but you could also have memory, the process. The problem is that memory as a word sort of applies to a few different things.
That's right.
The process and the results of the process. I guess it's kind of like fishing and fish. You fish to catch fish.
There you go.
Or you milk to get milk. They're all, you know, words that are a little awkward. Not as bad as buffalo, but...
You buffalo to get buffalo.
No. There's a famous sentence that is, buffalo, 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 buffalo. I think it's five buffaloes. And because buffalo works as a noun, a verb, an adverb, and an adjective. And so...
Wow, I didn't know
so
that.
So it's one of those words that can create a really awkward sentence. Anyway, this is completely off the topic, other than it shows you the kind of odd things that I remember.
And I actually like it. So... And anyway, we talked about filters relating to memories. We talked about the different types of memories. So if you ever, of course, want a replay of the show, go to breakradioshow.com, go to archives under Understanding Autism, and you can hear this over and over again. Back to you, Kim.
Well, so before the break, we were talking a little bit about savant syndrome. And that's basically something, I don't know, I've spoken with a lot of people, and we've talked about this on previous shows, but a lot of people associate the movie Rain Man with autism in general. So Rain Man, that's autism. That's the picture we have, is everybody like Rain Man, essentially. And, you know, you might hear different terms. Right now, the, I guess, most acceptable, appropriate term is savant syndrome. Yes, they used to call it idiot savant, which really referred to someone of very low intelligence but exceptional memory. And that was actually back even before, just like before the 1900s, that was used for anybody that had those kind of abilities. But
what does savant mean, the word savant?
It's for an exceptional, extraordinary memory.
Oh, that's what it
is. So basically, though, you might also hear autistic savant. And that's, I mean, I avoid using that because it's very misleading, because actually only about 10% of people on the spectrum have savant skills. Basically. And so just to kind of clear it up for everybody, in terms of every person with autism or most people with autism have savant skills, that's not really the case. But I did think it was interesting for us maybe to talk a little bit about savant skills, because you might see them to different degrees like slight degrees for people with autism and in terms of memory. And I actually have somebody that I work with who has a savant skill in the area of calendar calculating. And mm-hmm. so if you tell him any day, like he asks me, he likes to ask people, hey, when's your birthday? And you tell him your birthday, and he goes, oh, that was a Wednesday, you know, that year. And you know, he remembers.
Instantly. Do you know how they do it? Is it from a visual standpoint, they just see
it? Well, this is the thing, is it's not totally certain how the savant, I mean, how the brain exactly works for a person that has savant skills. But there are some things they've been able to pinpoint. Usually when somebody is labeled with savant syndrome, they have extraordinary memory, which we talked about. They can have lightning calculation, so it's instant. Like, you wouldn't even think they thought about it. It's almost like, well, lightning. They call it lightning calculation. Calendar calculating, musical ability, or artistic ability. Sometimes you might see things in the news, like, I can't remember who that person was. I flew over, I think it was New York. It was able to draw the whole city.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
They gave him some name, like the soccer for man or something like that. Yeah, no, they tested him over several different places, but he was able to fly over the city and get 99.9% of the detail right. Like, every now and then he might have, like, the wrong number of windows in the building, but even usually then it'd be, like, the right number of windows. He would,
City?
Yeah, no, they do, like, one 30-minute helicopter flyover, and then he would just, like, cover a wall with it.
Really?
Oh,
and
yeah.
So you have these skills, and part of that is that, you know, it really is about the brain being wired differently, that the brain has different amounts of activity in different areas. And so they have a lot more activity in areas that relate to skills like that, being able to remember that kind of details. I was reading a story recently, and it was a man, and he was completely normal in his life experience until he had an accident and had brain injury. And after that, he was a qualified math genius, basically, that he was able to understand very high-level mathematics, not just like, you know, do math in a snap, but able to understand and help in understanding, you know, high-level mathematical theorems, things like that, complex calculus, et cetera. And it was just a case of different parts of the brain are responsible for all of these different activities. I mean, your brain physically, think about the size of your head, your brain is not a small thing. And so the activities are spread out all over the course of it. And depending on which ones you can access and use well, you have different strengths and weaknesses. Hmm. And, you know, with a disorder like autism, that's a particular area that has a weakness. But with the brain, when one thing goes wrong, many things are likely to have gone wrong. That's why there are so many co-occurring conditions with autism. That's why you get other conditions, and that's why so many other mental disabilities also have co-occurring conditions that are mental. But oddly enough, savantism is a case of the brain not working right, because we consider right to be the normal way for the brain to work. So when you have one of these exceptional strengths, when you're one of the world's greatest artists or best at memorizing pictures or able to do that, that's actually something going wrong, but it's going wrong in a way that favors you, such as, you know, when, you know, the soda machine gives you a little bit of extra change or something, you know, that there's something that's gone wrong in the programming, but it helped you this time.
Mm.
And so that's what you're looking at here is...
Or it didn't help the owner of the vending
machine. Oh, it didn't help the owner of the vending machine. But in this case, with a person, you know, there's not someone else who's losing because you can draw perfect
right.
cityscapes.
So, you know, what's interesting, and I'll just ask the question, maybe you know the answer or not, but like the photograph man, you know, I would think that person would have really enhanced visual recall or coding. And music, I would think some type of auditory super enhanced situation. Does that make sense, or do you think?
Well, that's sort of what the case is, yeah, is that, you know, the guy who can draw the city from scratch, he remembers every detail of it. Like,
but he might see it in a picture, maybe, in his head, perhaps, right?
Possibly. I mean, he might code it some way completely different. Like, he might, you know, code it as, you know, a bunch of sort of rules. Like, you know, somehow he looks at a street and he sees it as 17317, and that's the floors of each of the buildings. And so, like, he might sort it, you know, it might be different from person to person how this works, but they...
Mm.
And you know, the way they describe it, the way they visualize it, doesn't necessarily correlate with how it's actually stored.
Yeah, that's
that,
probably right.
You know, it's,
yeah.
it's a translation process because brains, when you get down to it, brains stored as chemicals. We have no idea, like, you don't know what chemicals represent what memories. So there's a bunch of layers of abstraction, and that's just how he visualizes his storage and recall. And so she talked about someone who was great with dates. He may, you know, mentally have some idea of, you know, seeing it like you described, possibly seeing it as a calendar, and another person might see it as, like, they just have a sort of math formula to it that, you know how many days are in each year, you know how many, you know, whatever, you know, 365 and quarter days. So you do, you know, 2014 minus 1983, and you've got how many days back it is, and then you can figure out the day of the week from there. Or, you know, there's all kinds of different ways that it could be presented.
That's fascinating. How about?
But I think what people might help people understand, too, is when something isn't going right in the brain, in certain parts of the brain, other parts of the brain try to compensate for that. So other parts might grow stronger or differently as a result of something supposed to be happening that's not happening. And so the rest of the brain, it's almost like it knows that. It's trying to figure it out and activate this, that, and whatever to make it go.
And it's like healing. Like if you have a wound, your body tries to repair the damage. And where it can't, if, you know, you have a severe one, new veins or arteries try to form around it or whatever, that, you know, in the brain, and that's also part of why maybe you get people who are hypersensitive to noise, is because the part of the brain that's strengthened is the part of the brain that notices noise or that notices sense or something. And so it's one of those cases where the brain, when pathways aren't strong enough to one area, it tries to build new ones to process around it or to come up with other ways to processing things. And sometimes those help and sometimes those don't.
Would it be interesting at some point in the future, and do you think it's possible, to duplicate or replicate these ways of, you know, neural pathways or ways of storage of these type of memories if someone wanted to be able to remember like a phone book or something like that? That might be possible at some point.
I don't know. Well, here's the thing. With all the things we're able to do, fMRIs, looking at people's brains and what's activated and the size and all that sort of thing, I mean, that tells a lot. It's tricky because I don't know that any, like, ethical professional could do some sort of study or really advise anyone, because that could also mean that they could be, you know, doing, like, I want to say damage to other areas of their life. If, you know, I wouldn't say, oh, don't do this because I don't want you to strengthen this part of your brain. Only do this. I don't know how that would, if any professional would
advise
that.
You're asking questions that are going to be asked in about 25 to 50 years.
I think
you're
asking
of your
the
time.
Questions that there's a movement called the transhumanist movement. And the idea behind them is that we are just now beginning to have the technology to make ourselves more than we would be through natural processes. If you look at Google Glass here, Google Glass here is a way for me to quickly access memories outside of myself and communicate with people, and it's trying to bring it as close to, you know, no interaction as possible, where I just look up and ask questions of it. The next step then would be I don't have to look up and ask questions of it, that it has, you know, some way of, you know, through a pad or whatever that picks up, you know, skin conductivity, tells when I'm wondering something and shows me information. And then the next step is incorporating it. And this idea, through fMRI, we will eventually be able to figure out what parts of the brain do what, and you know, we'll be able to, as the resolution grows, follow a thought through the head, where you'll be able to show someone a picture and see which parts of their brain start moving chemicals around, which parts light up. And you show another person that picture, and you see which ones happen to them. And you do it to enough people, and you learn everyone who looks at this picture, these parts of their brain lights up. The next thing is we know what those chemicals are. Theoretically, we could alter those chemicals and someone would think they saw the picture. That's where the ethical question comes in, and that's where the question comes in with memory as well, is that we know that you can alter the brain from outside. Is there ever a situation where it's good to? And that's sort of, you know, one of the questions with autism is that, you know, a cure for autism may look like that. Is it okay to alter someone's brain, and how much say do they have in it once it's a disorder? And those are tough questions that we're going to have to ask, you know, in the near-ish future about this and memory. Because, you know, on the topic of memory, wouldn't it be interesting to see your wedding through your husband or wife's memories of it, so that you could share your memories of your wedding and you both saw the wedding from two different angles? If you could do that, is that okay? Who knows? Because in doing that, that also means that you could put in false memories what do you do then? So
well,
these
this
are
is like
tough,
a movie. Of...
Well, but this is the real world.
No,
now,
I know.
Is
I know.
This is our future that we're looking
you know,
at.
Other than the wedding, what would be way more interesting is the honeymoon.
Okay. That might be a bit inappropriate for our show here.
Yeah, just throwing it up. That's fine.
But, yeah, no, so anyway, that's what your question
it is.
Is asking is you
well,
know.
Well, things are going that way. I mean, with cloning and
yeah.
things. I mean, there's a tendency, you know, a trend to that. I mean, look at some of the movies already, Captain America, Iron Man, I mean, where they're
art. Well, the thing is even without,
mechanical.
You know, the surgical processes, you know, Google Glass has helped me manage some of my memories better. That it makes my calendar more directly available to myself. So the kind of things that I know I'm bad at encoding as memory, remembering appointments, remembering things like that, where in the past, you know, I might hear about an appointment and say, oh, I need to add that to my calendar when I get home. I can now, okay, Glass, remind me, you know, whatever, and immediately have that in it. And so we already have technology that the specific weaknesses with autism related to memory, we're beginning to be able to take it one step further and get a computer, a camera that watches my day. And that makes some people uncomfortable, but I think that it's one of those things we're going to become comfortable with in the near future. So a computer that watches my day and recognizes when someone asks me to do something, and maybe at the end of the day says, you know, we recognize that you agreed to do these five things. Do you want me to add them to your calendar for you? And so it not only reminds you of them then, but forces you to consciously think about them, and you practice then going back to your memories because the computer is sort of maintaining this for you as a combination personal assistant and training tool. And so as our technology gets better, these weaknesses for autism and other mental challenges where maybe you can live a day-to-day life, but you still have challenges and issues of executive function and issues of certain types of memory, it can be trained to just help you in those areas of specific weakness and do so in constructive ways.
And this is happening right now, real quickly, on our entertainment show on Saturday at 1480 AM KPHX. We had a cyborg, a real live cyborg, who hooked himself up measuring everything you can imagine physiologically is you know, heart rate. Is.
Remember the quantified self movement, I imagine.
Yeah, I'm not sure what movement, but and he was on the show. It's fascinating to me how he's done this for years, and he has all this data, and he could start. And he's starting to interpret the data in constructive ways. What's going to help him? That's sort of what you're talking about. And there's just a massive amount of you know his pulse, his blood pressure. And there's relationships he's starting to gather to see, you know, certain things that will be helpful. And that's an interesting show in itself. I think that was a couple months ago. You can also hear that on our archive under Breakthrough Entertainment. Why don't we take a quick break right now? We'll come back. We'll continue our discussion. This is Understanding Autism live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. We're talking about memory. Fascinating show today. And we'll be right back.
At Birenbaum and Spien PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-6000. 5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birenbaum and Spien works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinzen & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
And welcome back again. You are listening to Understanding Autism live here at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm Dave Isaac, alongside Kimberly, Isaac, Emery. Wow, new name. And Paul Loudon. And we're talking about memory and various filters as well as types of memory. We got into a cyborg even situation and very interesting situations. Very good show to replay at BreakRadioShow.com. Go to archives under Understanding Autism. So, Kim, do you have questions, or do you still have a few comments?
Well, I was just thinking we can kind of summarize some memory things, and then we do have some questions that we're going to answer. But I guess what I would want listeners to keep in mind is that, you know, don't assume that because your child is really strong at remembering something or, you know, some kind of memory, that means he should be strong at remembering, you know, or having strong memory in every area of his life. And just remember, with autism, it's, you know, executive functioning difficulties, that's what helps someone connect, you know, experiences and present action. And that's very different than the types of memory that we talked about earlier that are more focused on more concrete ideas and objects and facts. So just to keep that in mind, just so that it might help you to understand, no, he's not just choosing not to or not paying attention. That's not really the issue. So, do you have anything you want to add as a summary?
How about that?
Okay. Well, we do have some questions we thought we would answer here towards the end of our show. Somebody has asked, can someone get autism as an adult?
Well, the answer to that is a qualified yes. Because, one, autism isn't something you typically get. But you can point in your life that, you know, autism isn't progressive. It's a constant state. You basically have it, and it's always equally bad. But you can reach a point in your life where things become complicated enough that you know there's a problem. Maybe, you know, before the age of 30, you never really had a serious relationship, and now you really want to make a certain relationship more serious, and you start finding that you're running into unusual problems, and that leads you to the discovery of autism, that, you know, there could be a point in your life where you discover that you should have been diagnosed with autism much earlier. Like I said, I was diagnosed at the age of 23. Also, as I mentioned, there is the possibility of brain damage creating autism-like symptoms, that, you know, if you were in an accident or something, that when you recover from it, you may find that your interpretation of social events are now different from what they were previously. People's personalities change with accidents like that and something like autism or autism-like symptoms, because in that case, it probably wouldn't be diagnosed as autism necessarily, since we typically treat that as the disorder that you have from birth. But it's not something that you can catch. If you hang out with autistic people, you're not going to get it, anything like that. But there are times in an adult life where you may notice or discover autism symptoms.
Which is different than, like you said, you just can't catch it.
Mm-mm.
You probably had it. You didn't notice it. Something came up. Now you notice it.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
And it is more noticeable, like as Paul was saying, when things get more complex in terms of information or situations. A lot of times in times of transition, like I see a lot of people who are just getting into high school and now, you know, they're making this discovery or just getting into college. And really what that says is, you know, they were able to manage and process their daily life and things they were doing at the time. And now, as they're older and situation has changed, the demands are too great. They're not able to process and filter it out, and they're realizing, this is...
And college, especially, both the beginning of college and the end of college are two points where there's major transitions, because going into college, you are often going to live on your own. You no longer have, you go to class from 8 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon. You have variable schedules, different classes on different days, more so than you would in high school. And then upon leaving college, when you get employment and the system works, changes again. That both of those are very significant changes in your life that can show weaknesses in areas that you didn't necessarily need to have strengths in before.
Makes sense.
So,
great question.
So we have another question here. Let's see. Can someone have autism and ADHD at the same time? And if so, how do you know which is which? A good question.
You can have pretty much anything at the same time as anything for the most part, with limited exceptions when they actually contradict each other. But autism and ADHD you could absolutely have at the same time. The real question, I think, though, is not how can you tell them apart, but do you need to tell them apart? Because if you have both, do you really need to identify which is which? I mean, treat them separately. You treat a whole person who is dealing with conditions.
Yeah.
If someone, needs a wheelchair and they're deaf, then you treat both of them. And, maybe their spinal injury recovers and they can, start walking some through physical therapy, you still treat the deafness and it doesn't really change it because you're mostly treating the symptoms and trying to make them not need to suffer or address those symptoms anymore. And I think that if you have autism and you have ADHD, then what you do is instead of saying, okay, let's look at how ADHD affects learning and let's look at how autism affects learning, you say, let's, in a learning situation, look at what this person struggles with. And so you look at their problems, and you look at ways of addressing those problems, and you address autism like you address autism, you address ADHD like you address ADHD, and you look at which one of those are helping. So I think that it's not as important to differentiate the two beyond where necessary, just specifically for addressing specific problems. And I think in those cases, the differentiation will be more clear anyway.
And I just want to say that that's actually a pretty common occurrence. Like, there's a very high correlation between if you have a spectrum disorder, many times, I think maybe even like 70%, I'm not exactly sure, but from what I remember, that you're likely to have a co-occurring condition, or you might hear it called a comorbid condition, of ADD, ADHD, ODD, which is oppositional defiant disorder, anxiety, depression. They kind of all fall in that same pool of co-occurring disorders, and so there is a high likelihood of that, so it's not that uncommon either, actually, so it wouldn't be unusual, and
Another great question.
Yeah, it is.
Very helpful.
Let's see, and let's do one more. This one is, what are some tips that I could give our babysitter so that she has a bit of an idea about what autism is?
I would say that tips is the wrong angle to go at it from. If I had an autistic child and I wanted to hire a babysitter so that I could have some time with myself and my spouse, I would instead hire them to spend a few hours on a few separate occasions with us involved in the family life, where rather than trying to give them tips, I would want them to experience it firsthand. So, maybe going with me to take my child to the park, or maybe, a dinner time with my family a few times, or various other things, that I think that you can't really share the experience by words alone. Beyond that, when I'm at a radio show. But, I would try to do whatever I can to involve them in it and see what questions they have. And rather than trying to give them tips, trying to get them to ask questions, because you are the best expert on your child's autism, but you don't know in advance what the babysitter is going to feel they need to know.
And we talked about that. Really what you're also saying is you're developing a reference point as you experience it. So now she has data related specifically to the situation or not a situation, but the generalized situation, and he or she, whoever the babysitter is, will have a probably a better enhanced reference point than just saying, well,
here's some tips.
I agree. That makes sense.
Whatever. Yeah.
Very good.
Well, I also think that's a great idea also for the benefit of the child, because having someone
Yeah.
You know, especially like a new person, hiring a new babysitter and stuff is just to see. And actually for any child, it's really helpful for them to see that their parents are comfortable with that person and trust that person and, you know, give them a level of comfort in terms of, okay, I've seen her before. You know, I've heard her voice before. You know, just giving some of that
from
the comfort to you from the child's perspective.
Yeah, also the caregivers too.
And the caregivers too.
So it's a win-win-win.
Absolutely. I think so. Yeah.
Wow. Do you have? Well, we only have about 2 minutes left. Any other questions, or should we just summarize what we talked about today?
I think that's about it.
Yeah. And what's up tomorrow?
Tomorrow we're going to talk about the history of autism.
Oh, the history of autism.
I made up that title, so okay.
Oh, that's fine. No, I mean, isn't that what we sort of called it when we talked about it?
I don't know if that's exactly what we called it, but it just kind
of
came
out.
So.
You know, we've talked a little bit about what is autism, but part of understanding autism is understanding how we learned about it, like, you know, how we developed our understanding of it over time,
right.
What we saw first, what we started to learn about it over time, what we became more aware of as we said, hey, you know, it's not just these symptoms, there's also these things that usually go along with it or these things we thought were, and so on. So I think history of autism is good.
Well, that should be really, really good, and that's tomorrow 3 to 4 here on the Breakthrough Thinking Broadcasting Network. Well, Kim, Paul, thank you. See you tomorrow. This is Understanding Autism live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. Everyone have a great night.